Hi there, thanks for joining me today. This is Pollinators.info podcast episode 2. My name's Athena, I'm the author of Pollinators.info, and today we'll be talking with Sam Droege, who works for the U.S. Geological Survey, about bee and wasp surveys in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Well, thanks for joining us today.
Sure.
Can you start out by telling us what is your official job title?
I'm a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, and right now I'm running the North American Native Bee Inventory and Monitoring Lab.
Okay, so you're doing bee surveys at Guantanamo Bay, so can you give us a description of that project?
Yeah, Guantanamo Bay is the naval base, something like 36 square miles on the southeastern portion of Cuba. Their environmental groups are encouraging scientists to come out and do core surveys for different groups of animals. And until we had been there, they had, for example, no large-scale entomological surveys being done. So the immediate goal is to do an inventory of the bees and wasps of Guantanamo Bay. To put that into context, the larger picture is that because there is very limited access to the rest of Cuba, this becomes our one place that we can look at Cuban bees relatively easily, even though it is on a military base. At this point, we've found over 30% of the bees that are known to have occurred on Cuba. And the reason this is important is just knowing something about the base and knowing about the habitats that occur on the base and how important the base might be, the habitats they contain for the conservation of bees in Cuba. It also allows us to do comparisons with other islands in the Caribbean. And so other groups are looking at more accessible islands around the Caribbean, and we can play the part of adding information about what the bees are like on Cuba.
Right.
But maybe I should add on to that there is a fair amount of historic information, and so we do have a way of contrasting the bees we're finding in Guantanamo Bay to what's known elsewhere in Cuba, but this is the only place that we're getting new information.
Okay, so what does it mean to do a survey for bees and wasps?
We use three techniques on the bees. One is we have little traps, and these are nothing more than colored bowls, blue, yellow, and a white, that are filled with soapy water. The bees are attracted to the color. If you think of a bee, when a bee gets up in the morning, the first thing it's looking for is color, because color is a very unusual aspect to the natural environment, not, of course, to man-made environment, but to a natural environment. Anything that's blue or yellow is very novel, and that's why flowers have developed those color schemes, is because they stand out. It attracts bees. And so a bee doesn't necessarily know that a little colored bowl filled with soapy water is not a flower, so it comes over, investigates, and lands in the water. And we have further tricked them because the soap gets rid of the surface tension. And what would normally happen, and bees do this all the time, is they land on top of water to gather water for their nest or for just maybe perhaps by accident. And the wasps do this too, because many wasps come to flowers. They would be on the surface tension, but the surface tension is gone with soap, and the soap actually kills them too. So they land in the bowl, and we then identify the specimens. That's one technique. The other is a traditional one of an entomologist out there with a net hunting bees on flowers or looking for nest sites and catching them in the air. It turns out in Cuba that is a relatively difficult thing to do because, first of all, it's often very hot and sweaty. Second, a lot of the habitat in that part of Cuba is cactus and thorn scrub. We're not talking little tiny cactus either, or cacti. We're talking cactus that are upwards of 25 to 30 feet tall.
Oh.
And so that combination makes the physical landscape a little more difficult than normal. But additionally, for some reason, the amount of visible bees can be low. So we may only get a few bees for a whole hour's worth of looking for them, whereas elsewhere we'd be dealing with several hundred.
Okay.
And finally, the last technique is we set up these things called malaise traps, which are big, essentially net tents that have a collecting jar at the top of the tent, and bees blunder into them and wander up into the collecting head, and we periodically pick up the bees and we then sort through them later.
Okay, some people might not know what traditional bee catching means and why cacti are not good.
Sure. So, I guess many people would call this a butterfly net. There's a handle, a hoop at the end of that handle, and then there's a netting bag. And what one does is go out into the environment, mostly looking for flowers. And then you look for bees that might be visiting those flowers, and then you try and intercept those bees with your net. And it sounds pretty easy, but bees are super fast, and they have to avoid a lot of different predators that try to catch them, eat them. So if you sort of mosey up to them with a net, mostly they're gone by the time your net gets to anywhere near where you thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they're moving very quickly, too. They're not lounging around on flowers. They're usually sitting. So it becomes a bit of a skill to be able to quickly net a bee on flowers. And then on top of that, you have all these thorny plants. And because you have this cloth net bag that's just netting, the two don't go well together. So a lot of times you're snagging your net on cactus and snagging it on a big thorn scrub, which are worse than cactus, and ripping your net open. Or at least you're having to limit what kind of flowers you can get, because if you have a lovely flowering thorn tree, it doesn't do any good because you can't swing a net onto the flower. You have to try and catch them coming and going, and that's even more difficult.
Right. So which one of those three methods do you usually get more bees with?
Oh, certainly the what we call bee bowling, the putting out of these little bowl traps. On each of the trips, we put out about 1,000 traps all across the base during that time period. And the traps are out only for a day, and then we move them a different place. So bees, in general, are not out early in the morning and late in the afternoon. So we'll get up at dawn, put out traps all morning long, and then we come back in the afternoon, pick up the traps, and then we go to bed.
And then get up and do it again the next morning.
And we do it over and over again.
I was going to ask, how long does it usually take for you to, from start to finish, of doing one of these bee surveys?
Well, it depends on what you mean by start to finish, but we're usually there for, or have been there, we've done three trips now, for somewhere between 10 days and 2 weeks. And, you know, there's times when the weather's not good, and there's lots of different areas we want to get to on the base, and I think people would not be surprised to hear that there's access issues.
Yeah.
And you can't just wandering around in these areas as you might on a national park.
So how do you decide where you're going to put your bee bowls?
Oh, we do that based, first of all, on experience, where we have found good numbers of bees in the past. We try to cover all the habitats. So on the base, you have mangroves along the saltwater areas. You have some sandy areas and beach-like habitat along the ocean side. There's internal fields and disturbed sites where there's been military training or old buildings or even current barracks, those sorts of situations. You have several different kinds of native scrub habitats that occur on the base. So each of those areas may have, and does, have a different group of bees that are either nesting in the soils of those, or more importantly, are using different plant species in each of those habitats. So the way bees work in many cases is that they have preferences for what they feed their young. So females are mixing pollen and nectar and provisioning a nest of some kind. A lot of times, though, those females are very much specialists or gathering pollen only from one group of plants, maybe a single genus, maybe sometimes even a single species of plant. So, and those plants have their preferences as to what part of the island they occur on and what part of the base they occur on, too. So, we really do need to cover as many habitats as possible.
Right. So, people might wonder, if pollinators are declining and we're supposed to be doing something to conserve them, how do we justify killing bees as part of that process?
Right. So, that's an important question. There's a couple things going on here. One, they're not like birds. So, with birds, you can use a pair of binoculars, you can be fairly certain of the identification of a bird based on their characteristics, which you can easily see if they're standing still or they're calling or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with bees is, in addition larger bees are often difficult to separate from one another because there may be three or four species that all look about the same. Mm-hmm. So we have to look at them under the microscope to tell what they are. So that means catching and killing them. Additionally, if we back up, you mentioned that there was a problem with pollinator decline. That's a public perception, an immediate perception, and not necessarily what's going on the ground. And a lot of our surveys, we're still finding that native species still exist, and often in very large numbers. So if you look at what proportion of the bees that we are capturing might be to the total population of bees, it turns out that it's essentially trivial.
All right, so did you mention that there were some other agencies involved in the survey?
Yes, so this is a collaborative project between the USGS and the Smithsonian. And in fact, the Smithsonian funded the first two visits to Guantanamo Bay. And of course, we've been doing this in conjunction with the environmental group of the Navy, who is in charge of the animals on the base and their conservation. And then the last trip actually funded myself. It just took vacation time to go because I was so psyched, shall we say, I guess, about finishing up the project, and we had run out of money at the Smithsonian.
Oh, bummer.
It's not that big a deal.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to go somewhere for vacation. Who wouldn't want to go to a place where you're sweating and full of cactus and it's hard to find bees?
And you need an armed escort.
Right.
Okay, so having talked about that, what would you say has been the most challenging aspect of the project?
Well, actually, logistics are very challenging because of the number of areas that are under some kind of security. It's not too difficult. Most of those areas you get permission to go into, it just slows things down. I have had a kind of obscure problem. Normally, we put out our traps and we'll leave them out overnight and then pick them up the next day. And on our first trip, we realized that something was eating the traps. Like, something between 25% and 30% of the traps would be completely chewed up. They seem to love to chew the bottoms out for some reason. And it turns out that it was these giant rodents called Hutia, which are related to capybaras.
Oh, wow.
And elsewhere in Cuba, apparently, they're very uncommon because they taste good.
Oh.
Whereas on the base, they sort of overrun the place. So right now, we can only leave the traps out during the day and have to pick them up before it gets dark.
Well, that's interesting. So there's a giant rodent eating your traps.
Right, which I have not had problems with before. There's a giant rodent.
Okay, so what's been your favorite part of the project?
I think the favorite part of my project has just been the novelty of both on Cuba in the Caribbean island, and is finding these new and unfamiliar species of bees that I don't get to see in North America. There's mm-hmm. a number of species that are endemic to Cuba. There are a number that are endemic to the Caribbean. We've ended up finding probably somewhere between 2 and maybe 4 new species of bees that haven't been described to science.
Oh, neat.
And maybe some that are new to Cuba, and others that were thought formerly to be rare, and we're finding them recently common
mm-hmm.
on the Cuban Isle. So it makes it much more like an exploration into new territory than, say, simply bird watching in the area, which the birds are fairly well known.
Right.
You're not going to find anything new. But with bees, almost anywhere, we're going to find new species and something interesting, and that's indeed been the case here.
Right. So you said there are endemic bees in Cuba.
Yes, and the total number of bees known from Cuba are only 90. That may sound like a fair amount, but for example, in Maryland, where I live, we have something close to 420 species known. Maryland's much smaller than Cuba, so that's a little odd. We don't know why, just one of the reasons to study bees on a different island. So, from past work by the Cubans on bees on their islands, it's known that a fairly high percent of the bees that are known from Cuba are found only on Cuba, so that makes them an endemic.
Yeah.
Species.
So, do you have any initial results from the survey?
We have worked up the first two trips, and we've got, I think the estimated number was 35 species, so we're over a third of the known bees from Cuba. We're still working out the identification of some, and we're trying to define whether some of these species that we don't have a name for are are found on other islands or are new species. I should also point out, which I did before, we've been talking about bees a lot, but we also have been catching any wasps that have been in the area. From those preliminary results we have, we know there's at least two new species involved, and there could be more.
Yeah.
So it'll be the bees and wasps of Cuba, and we're all very pleased with the catch that we've gotten so far. Far richer than we first suspected.
Okay.
We thought because that part of Cuba is the driest portion of the island, the average rainfall is only something like 19 inches. And it wasn't very well known. And initially, we were surprised because it was considered to be just a small pocket of unusual habitat. We were surprised by how many of the other species on the rest of the island we were finding there. We didn't expect to have, say, somewhere between a third and a half of the species of Cuba show up in this region. So that's also been very interesting.
Yeah, okay. What would be some broader implications from the work for the general public?
Well, one of the things that we will be doing is we're establishing a baseline so we can look at changes over time. There is this notion that pollinators are declining or could decline, so in our establishing this as something that can be repeated in the future, then you can look at whether things have changed on the base or not. We're doing some very basic science things, so we're adding some new species to the list. We're getting a feel for how things work on islands. Other collaborators from other parts of the Caribbean are interested in the species that we have, so they can compare it to Jamaica, to Hispaniola, to Puerto Rico, some of the islands in the region. For bees, we can add an economic angle, which is that if you don't have bees, some of these plants that occur on the base or even in better crops in nearby Cuba are not going to get pollinated.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing at least a little bit something about that gives us some perspective on what's available to access crop pollinators.
Right. So as a final take-home message for the public, what would you recommend for people to do in their lives or their communities or their gardens to conserve bees and wasps and other pollinators?
Right. Well, the one thing that I can tell people that they can do to plant and encourage native plants on your property. Doesn't have to be a lot. Instead of planting zinnias and geraniums and begonias, planting things like sunflowers and coreopsis and some of the native hollies and that sort of thing, those provide both the habitat and the food and pollen and nectar that are important to bees, and it encourages wildlife in a stronger community, plants and animals,
mm-hmm.
and it's something that you can do. So every yard has bees in it, but a lot of times they're just making do with feeding off of a few dandelions or weeds rather than the things that we plant. And we make choices based on color, but a lot of the commonly planted plants you might buy at a big box store are essentially devoid of pollen and nectar because they've been bred too much for color and presentation and disease resistance and have lost their pollen and nectar on the way because they're propagated artificially.
Mm-hmm. So native plants for native pollinators. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sam.
You bet, Athena.
Once again, that was Sam Droege with the U.S. Geological Survey talking with us here at pollinators.info about a native bee and wasp survey that they're doing in Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. You've been listening to pollinators.info podcast episode 2. My name's Athena. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care, and I'll see you next time.